You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show, which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. And this weekend on The Weekend, we have a two-part show. The first part is with Dr. Sally Perry. Dr. Sally Perry is the executive director of the Sinclair Lewis Society. She's also an associate dean at Illinois State University, and she's here to talk about a book that was written in 1935, and all of a sudden, it's like, what happened here? And the book is It Can't Happen Here. Dr. Perry, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about, first of all, about Sinclair Lewis, because probably a lot of students, either in English class in high school or even in college, were asked to read one of Lewis's books.
Sure. Sinclair Lewis was probably the best-selling author of the 1920s. He had five major books: Main Street, which I'm sure a lot of students and other of your listeners might have read, Babbitt about business, Aerosmith about medicine, Elmer Gantry about hypocritical televangelists, and Dodsworth about Americans in Europe. In 1930, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, and he was the first American to do so. So it was a very big deal, and it gave a sense of seriousness to American literature that I don't think had happened before. In 1935, he writes It Can't Happen Here, which was another major success and a critical success as well. It also caused a lot of controversy about whether or not fascism could happen in America.
And so a lot of his books were, and correct me if I'm wrong, were considered sort of controversial. And when he won the Pulitzer, or he was nominated for one, I forget which one it was, he said that that prize he didn't deserve because it was about wholesome living or something like that. And that's not what he wrote about.
Well, it's kind of a complicated answer in the sense that, yeah, he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Aerosmith, which was a novel about American medicine, and both his father and his brother were doctors, and so he was writing from medicine on the inside out. However, it was very critical both about medicine at a county level and research at research institutions, and how much of medicine was kind of medicine for pay. In other words, if you had enough money, you could get anything done that you wanted. I know there are correlations today. He turned it down, and there are a couple of reasons. One is that at the time, the Pulitzer was supposedly for the best and most wholesome portrayal of American life, and he said that's just not me. I'm trying to show American society, warts and all. He had also been recommended for the Pulitzer for both Main Street in 1920 and Babbitt in 1922, and in both cases, the Columbia Board of Trustees overturned the recommendation and gave it, in one case, to Edith Wharton and in the other to Willa Cather. So he was kind of ticked off as well. And, you know, on a kind of practical note, he was a very savvy businessman, unlike some authors, and so by turning it down, he probably got well more than the $1,000 worth of publicity that the award was worth. Now, when it came to the Nobel Prize, that's for a body of work. It was a lot more money, and also the prestige was different. Because, you know, there's often a sort of a canard about Pulitzer Prize novels that they're kind of second-rate literature because the really good literature isn't appreciated by the Pulitzer Committee. And Lewis really didn't want to be considered part of that group.
So some critics have said that his story, It Can't Happen Here, that a lot of it he probably owes to his wife, who was a journalist.
Mm-hmm. That's probably true. His wife was Dorothy Thompson. She was his second wife. She was a foreign correspondent, one of the first American foreign correspondents who was a woman. And in the early 1930s, she interviewed Adolf Hitler and, you know, didn't think much of him. She thought he was kind of a show-off and a blowhard. And she wrote a book, an incisive book called I Saw Hitler! Exclamation point. Hitler threw her out of the country, and she didn't go back until after the end of the war. Now, she was writing from real knowledge. She was fluent in German and had traveled all over Europe. Lewis also traveled a lot in Europe, and I think that her discussions with people, with refugees and so forth, at their home in Vermont really helped to help Lewis to understand sort of the magnitude of the crisis that the world was in, and helped his writing of the book, because, you know, earlier in the 30s, he had actually been an isolationist. He had been part of America First, which and Charles Lindbergh was another well-known member of this group. It was isolationist. It was xenophobic, and became more so. And you know, it was to be understood, I think, because there were so many people who were unemployed or underemployed during the Great Depression. We were less than 20 years from the end of World War One, so people just didn't want much to do with the world at large. And I think Lewis's association with Thompson was an education, so it sort of made him see why it was important to engage with issues and become involved, and that kind of education becomes part of the impetus for the novel.
We are visiting with Dr. Sally Perry, and Dr. Perry is the executive director of the Sinclair Lewis Society, and we're talking about the book It Can't Happen Here. And this is incredible, Sally, the fact that this summer, you know, when we were hearing about the campaign, the presidential campaign, the sales of this book, It Can't Happen Here, went up almost 3,000% over last year. That is incredible.
It's amazing. I know that they had to do another print run because they ran out. So they've done another print run since then. But yeah, it's, you know, it was over 2,600% in hard copies, and another, you know, 1,500% in ebooks. So, you know, that's really amazing for a book that's quite that old. I mean, last week somebody sent me something saying that last week alone this novel was referenced 290,000 times on Twitter. So it's obviously striking at something that people are disturbed about by the new regime in Washington.
Because, well, you mentioned Twitter, and as we all are aware, our new president is a big user of Twitter. Has he responded at all to this novel and what happened this summer and how it continues to sell?
Yeah, not that I'm aware of. Although he said he admits he's not much of a reader, so perhaps it hasn't percolated through. I don't know.
And I just want to cover this, the media coverage of when this book was again read this summer. And NPR did a review on it, I remember. I believe Fresh Air did. Time Magazine says the book, people are saying, predicted Donald Trump's rise as reviewed in 1935. The New Yorker, getting close to fascism with Sinclair Lewis, It Can't Happen Here. Money says It Can't Happen Here sells out online, which was what you were talking about. Salon.com, books old and new in 2016 got boost from Trump candidacy. And The Washington Post, how does Donald Trump stack up against Americans' literature fictional dictators? Well, pretty well, actually. And that was in June 2016. And finally, the Houston Chronicle says the novel and play that predicted Donald Trump's rise. Wow.
I know.
And what would you say about, because a lot of these people like Sinclair Lewis, mm-hmm. Upton Sinclair, Philip Roth, The Plot Against America, and, you know, The Jungle, all this stuff, were predicting stuff like that. Animal Farm, 1984. And people are going, wow, you know, these guys had a crystal ball or what?
Well, you know, I think that, and this is something that Lewis brings up in the novel, is that it's really easy for people to say, you know, just your average citizen to say, okay, things are going along well enough, so I don't need to get really involved because, you know, it'll all work out. And then what happens is that you don't get involved, and terrible things happen. One of the other things too is that Lewis, I think, like Roth, like Margaret Atwood with A Handmaid's Tale, that sort of thing, they're looking at the sort of underside of American society, the side of society that isn't lifted up. And, you know, we've seen politicians for a long time now say, well, we'll try this version, and those people who feel disenfranchised will get lifted up by it. Most of the time, this doesn't work. I mean, I'm trying to think that maybe with the Works Progress Administration back in Franklin Roosevelt's day, when there was a major campaign to hire people for the Civilian Conservation Corps and that sort of thing. But, you know, some of the other economic forms haven't been very successful, but people, especially if they're feeling afraid or they're feeling like they're not getting what they deserved, will be intrigued, be attached to somebody who promises real change and who talks differently, who talks in a way that they think real people, however we're identifying real people, how real people talk, and so that if it seems sort of unfiltered by media, unfiltered by various other kinds of concerns, they'll say, this is the real thing. And I'm sure that speaks to a lot of Trump's popularity, that he sounds like somebody you'd be talking to in a bar. And so it sounds less practiced, less formal, and I think a lot of people identified with that.
Dr. Perry, some people may wonder, because as you are well aware, and being a college dean, I'm a faculty member here as well, we know that some young people, a lot of millennials especially, don't like to read anymore. They like to go to the movies. And so the question is, why wasn't this ever made into a movie, or perhaps now it will, that so much attention has been drawn to it?
Well, that's an excellent question, and the answer is it almost was. MGM bought it for the movies shortly after the play came out in 1936, and Lionel Barrymore was signed to do the leads, and everybody knows Lionel Barrymore is the evil Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life, so he was signed to play Doremus Jessup, the newspaper editor. There was a lot of pressure that was put on MGM by bankers and the Wall Street folk back east who helped, you know, fund the movies, saying that this made the government look unstable. It, you know, cast a bad eye on capitalism, and that it would be very destructive to the country for the novel to be made into a movie, which I think shows its power, and that's very cool. But it also shows the influence of Wall Street types to kind of call the tune. And you know, the movie industry tends to follow trends rather than create them. And Louis Mayer backed down, and a movie was not made.
But, however, several successful plays were made, correct?
Yeah, there was a production, the Works Progress Administration, arm of the Federal Theater Project, did a production that was written by Lewis and a playwright named J.C. Moffat. And they did it. There were 21 productions done in 18 cities, and they all opened on the same night. So it was kind of like fascism spreading. And there was a production in Spanish. There was a production in Yiddish. There was a production in Seattle where the fascists were white and the average people were black, which I was told was a very telling sort of thing. And then last year in the Berkeley Rep commissioned a new version of the play, of the novel. And that was very successfully done, and there was also a national reading across the country on a particular day in October where community theater groups, libraries, reading groups of various sorts, universities also did a reading all on the same day, just again to get the sense of it's bigger than any one of us, that it's happening across the country, and that's why people, so in a broad sense, really need to be involved and to be thinking about what our country is turning into.
We are visiting with Dr. Sally Perry, and she is the executive director of the Sinclair Lewis Society. She is also associate dean at Illinois State University. Dr. Perry, if you wouldn't mind giving us perhaps if the society has a webpage or a Facebook page that our listeners can go to find out more about the Sinclair Lewis Society, and also perhaps if they haven't read the book, or it's been a while since they read it, they want to read it again.
Sure. Yes, we do indeed have a web page. You can do a Google search for Sinclair Lewis Society, and it should come up. Otherwise, it's at english.illinoisstate.edu/SinclairLewis. And we have information on the society, on Lewis's life, on his works, on movies that have been made of his other novels. And also, if any of your listeners are teachers, there are resources for how to teach some of his novels as well.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here today. We really appreciate it. We've been visiting with Dr. Sally Perry. Dr. Perry is the executive director of the Sinclair Lewis Society, also an associate dean at Illinois State University. Dr. Perry, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The weekend will continue right after this. And welcome back, and joining us on the second half of the weekend are David Robles. He is a graduate student, a PhD candidate here at the University of Texas at El Paso, and Dr. Sam Brunk and Yolanda Leyva. Both are professors at the University of Texas at El Paso here, History Department. Dr. Brunk is the chair, and Dr. Leyva is one of the professors here, and they're going to talk about something very interesting that's going to be taking place a week from today, and that is the UTEP Borderlands History Conference. Thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having us.
So let's start first of all with you, Dr. Brunk. Tell us a little bit about, as the chair of the department, we hear sometimes about people saying, well, you know, people are forgetting their culture, they're forgetting their history, they're not reading, they're watching movies, all that stuff. How important is it to have something like this, especially a Borderlands History Conference?
Well, I think it's very important, obviously, for our region to promote the history of this place, and in this case, with this conference, to draw people from both sides of the border to talk about that history. And we have a doctoral program in which we have a whole bunch of students with that sort of focus who are kind of looking at the border up and down from Texas to California, and sometimes doing comparative things. And so, I mean, I think that it's very important.
And we've had Dr. Avon before, and some people are not really, or they're surprised at just how rich in history our border is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I don't know why people would be surprised. But
people who are not from
it
here.
It certainly is. And people who are not from here might not know very much about it. And that's, again, one of the goals of the conference, is to sort of focus that kind of research and to give our doctoral students that opportunity to see what's going on, what other people are doing, and to give the community that opportunity as well.
And as I mentioned, this conference starts on February 10th, and I'm going to break it down and go by the different days and the different panels. But interesting, you know, we're on the radio, and the fact that we are here talking about this, radio is a medium that has always been around, and not just serving as entertainment, but information during World War II, during Pearl Harbor, during different things. People would turn into the radio to listen to the Fireside Chats or whatever else.
Exactly. And thinking about radio on the border, people on the U.S. side of the border have always listened to Mexican radio, for example, and the famous Tintan, actor, comedian, musician of the 30s and 40s, started out with a radio show in Juarez.
I wasn't aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also, I mean, just the other month, I was just watching Netflix, and I was watching a documentary on border radios, and it was showing that a lot of bluegrass and country artists from Tennessee, such as the Carter family, you know, very famous family, had a, you know, perform at the radio station Del Rio, now across the Rio, Texas. And that station, you know, it amplified, and people all across the U.S. could hear it. So they will use that.
And we mentioned that because, and you're absolutely right, David, the fact that border radio started back in the 1950s and even earlier, because, and Wolfman Jack was one of the ones who took advantage of that, because they didn't have any regulations. So they had these powerful transmitters that some people would say that the birds would get near the transmitter and they would just fry. The United States does have regulations, but again, radio is something that we really are tuned into. We hear audiobooks, and oral history is very important. And I know that you're going to share something about that at the conference. So why don't you kind of fill us in on that, Yolanda?
The opening event of the conference will be an oral history workshop sponsored by the Institute of Oral History here at UTEP. We've been around since the early 1970s. We were founded by Dr. John McNeely, and I'll tell you in a second about an exciting commemoration of his work. And we're going to spend a couple of hours with participants in the conference talking about how to conduct an oral history, what kinds of projects you can do with oral history, and also talking about cultural competence in oral history. Sometimes people go into oral histories with somebody very different from them, from a very different background or different culture. So we're going to talk about how are you self-reflective in that process so that you see your privilege and your power as the interviewer.
And sometimes, I guess, as the interviewer, they end up finding out something that they weren't aware of, or perhaps that they have something in common and something that we take for granted, walking, pass by it, read about it, whatever. And it's as you did, I guess it was last year that you had the area down in Segundo Barrio where it was people were a little bit, wow, I didn't know so much history was here.
Right. And, you know, the border is, well, I guess everywhere is just full of stories, full of histories. And oral history is a great way to document those stories. It's the creation of really primary documents that future researchers can use. And I'm director of the Institute of Oral History, and every day I'm very grateful to Dr. McNeely for having founded this back in 73 or 4. So 2017 is the centennial of Dr. McNeely's birth. He was a history professor here at UTEP from the 40s up until 1980 and contributed a great deal to our understanding of border history. He was a pretty amazing guy. So we thought, since this is the centennial of his birth and since he was the founder of oral history, perhaps we could do an award, start an award that would be presented annually to graduate students using oral history. So this is the inauguration of the Dr. John H. McNeely Graduate Student Oral History Award. And I'm very excited because his family is coming from Colorado to attend this first award in his honor. And President Natalicio will be here also to honor him. We have two winners of the award. Both papers were so excellent we couldn't choose, so we decided to inaugurate it with two awards.
We are visiting with Dr. Sam Brunk, who is the chairman of the history department here at UTEP. Also, Dr. Yolanda Leyva, executive director of the Oral History Project here at UTEP, and David Robles, who is a PhD candidate in history. And we're talking about the UTEP Borderlands History Conference, Shifting Borders, Gender, Family, and Community. Sam, if you wouldn't mind sharing with us a little bit about, is this the first time that a conference like this is focusing on the family, community, and gender?
It is, as far as I know, the first time. We are trying to institute this as a annual event, but there are different themes every year, and so this is only the second annual Borderlands History Conference, and certainly the first one that had this gender, family, and community focus.
Now, and tell us a little bit about what is involved in obviously, you have to reach out way ahead of time to get some of these speakers. And if you wouldn't mind kind of breaking it down, because it's going to be over a couple of days. It's a weekend, Friday and Saturday. If you wouldn't mind sharing with us some of what can people expect?
Well, I think they can expect, first of all, one of the events that I think might most interest people in the community is our keynote speaker, Sonia Hernandez, who will be speaking on Friday night at 6:30. And her talk is entitled A Transnational Feminists Network of Women from Tampico to South Texas and Beyond, 1900 to 1940. And so she's talking about the border farther down along the Rio Grande and looking at feminist organizing across the border on both sides. And this is, she's sort of drawing on bigger projects. She has a very well-received book, Working Women into the Borderlands, that was published a couple of years ago by Texas A&M University Press. So that's a big event that people can expect. But beyond that, oh, I'm sorry.
I wanted just to add a little bit about our keynote speaker, because one of the things that I find very intriguing about her work is that she's part of a group of historians that have created a project called Refusing to Forget. And you can find more information about it at www.refusingtoforget.org. This project seeks to document the effects of the anti-Mexican violence in South Texas in the early part of the century, and it led to really a groundbreaking museum exhibit at the State History Museum, the Bob Bullock Museum in Austin last year. And I think that our conference is part of this hopefully growing trend to look at subjects that are not always easy to look at but are part of the history of the border.
We'll come back to talk a little bit about some of the other panels, but we have with us also David Robles, and David is a PhD candidate here at the University of Texas at El Paso in history. And David, tell us a little bit about what you've been doing. I'm sure that you've going to grad school is no easy task, and you've been doing so much that you even forgot to sing, you told us.
I don't do the music thing anymore. Okay. But no, it is graduate school. It's a good challenge on itself. But having the responsibility and honor of organizing the conference is another level, in the sense that I have to still read my sources for my dissertation. I still have to write, and I still have to answer emails all day until like maybe 7 or 8 p.m. That's when I have to literally pull myself from the computer and just relax. But no, it's quite challenging, but it's not impossible, and I'm really enjoying it. The experience is phenomenal. So much for the things that I've been doing so far, contacting the registrants, presenters, talking to a lot of the vendors. It's something I've never thought I would do in graduate school, but it's given me a great experience, and hopefully in the later future, when I do move on and, go to another institution for work, it will help me, in case I really want to create a border conference myself, if I end up in a border institution as well.
So tell us, because I'm sure our listeners want to know, what is your dissertation on?
My dissertation focuses on South Texas, mainly the city of Far Texas. I look at a police riot that happened in 1971 during the Chicano movement. And unlike a lot of my Chicano colleagues, what I do is I not only look at the event, but I look before the event, what caused social inequality in the region where ethnic Mexicans were considered second-class citizens to Anglos. And then I look after the event, maybe 10 years, 15 years after, and see the progress, or if there was any progress that came about in the city, after the first Mexican-American mayor was elected into office. A lot of ethnic Mexicans, got better social services, social equality. So that's the gist of my dissertation, is just trying to look at this community and see how the movement itself, changed the city.
And what a network you're building by reaching out to people as part of organizing this, so you get to touch base with all these people.
Oh, correct. Exactly. And that's what conferences are. I mean, not only for my dissertation, but a lot of individuals come in and have different themes, different topics, and graduate students here at UTEP and those who are coming in to participate get to network and get to share information and ideas, any books they've read. It's a community, and we are a community within ourselves, and we like to share knowledge, and it usually helps us with our own work, or we help them with their own work.
Sam, is this a conference that is geared open to the community, or is it just for history people?
It's certainly open to the community, and people can get more information on our website, borderhistoryconf.utep.edu, or call the department at 747-5508, but it's open, and certainly that keynote address on Friday night, I think, would be of great interest to members of the community.
I'm interested a little bit about panel 4, if you wouldn't mind sharing with us about what will be happening on Saturday.
All right. So panel 4 is religious communities, saints, brothers, and the dead in the borderlands. And so this is we got a lot of good papers, interesting papers that deal with, in some facet, deal with religion on the border. And we have a couple of two of our students are on this panel, and one of our former students is on this panel. And so it's a little bit of a happy moment where our UTEP students will be coming in contact with each other. And they're going to be talking about everything from, Matachines, to the penitentes in northern New Mexico. So a lot of interesting topics there.
And again, this will kick off on February 10th and 11th. Friday, it starts at what time does it start? I forgot to mention that.
It starts at 4 o'clock. The first panel is 4 o'clock on Friday. Well, but the oral history workshop is noon to 2 on Friday afternoon.
And then the keynote speaker will be speaking that evening, Dr. Hernandez?
At 6:30. Mm-hmm.
Again, we are talking about the UTEP Borderlands History Conference, Shifting Borders, Gender, Family, and Community, which starts February 10th and 11th, and it will be at the El Paso Natural Gas Conference Center from 4 to 7:30 p.m., and then Saturday we'll move over to the Hilton Garden Inn, and that will be from 8:30 to 5 p.m., and then wrapping it up, dinner and festivities at Café Mayapan from 7 to 10. Thank you all very much for being with us here today.
Thank you.
The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Kim Garcia. Our producer is Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Luis Sainz.